Hello, my name is Sam. This is a series best listened to from the beginning, but if you have and you're still here, our last episode finished our first tale of the village and the boys' major triumph. We returned to our scene with the grad student and the old man and pick up from there. Please enjoy The Scribbling Man.
How had so much of a story issued forth from the man while I was getting and finishing some coffee? I obsessed the night away imagining the possibilities of devising an ethical experiment to test whether or not this was a one-shot thing.
The following day, I got the same table on the sidewalk and waited. All day. And the next. The third day, I saw him shambling along the far side of the park across from the cafe. I began calming myself with deep breaths so I couldn't sound too pushy in my excitement. Eventually, he meandered by, and I made the same offer. "Is that the nice young lady from the other day?" he asked. The man took a deep sniff of the area and laughed to himself. "I remembered smelling lilacs when we met." "That's quite all right. I get it all the time." "You do?" he asked, sounding scandalized. "No, not really," I say jokingly. "Just realized there's some in the park I must be smelling," he says. He hooted and laughed just as he had a few days ago. Then it announced, "Cream and sugar, please." And he felt around for a seat. Being who I am, I had a pad and pen perfectly placed for him to start scribbling on. Sure enough, his right hand, seemingly on its own accord, attacked the pen like a king cobra striking prey and began scratching at the pad. The blur, that's what sticks out most to me this time around. The pen was literally a blur. I finally tore myself away to get coffee, but he was gone when I got back. I frowned and looked around, but saw nothing that gave away his departing direction. The pen was on a page of the tablet about a third of the way through. Weighing it down while the pages he filled flapped gently in the breeze, I began to read. The boy had been gone for days. For the first two, his mother and sister willed themselves not to worry about it. By the third and then fourth, they could not help but beg the chief to go look for him. The chief himself was starting to get worried too, but he had faith in the boy's resourcefulness. He cleared his mind and tried to remember anything from 4 days past that could have interested the boy so much. There was a giant storm front in the distance to the west. As he remembered more details, he was convinced the flashing of the clouds must have drawn the little wanderer. The chief set out to track him. He inspected the area around the boy's hut and found small foot tracks trampled under a worried tread in front of its opening. They eventually escaped the flurry of scurried footprints and made a nearly perfect line west into the grasses outside the village. The sun was halfway up the sky behind him, so the chief marked the tracks slightly to the side, so his shadow was not cast on the clues. It was difficult in the taller grasses, but his ability to track gazelle made the boy's footprint seem loud. Soon, more rock began appearing on the ground, and he had to be more vigilant, as the boy took the most comfortable route for his bare feet. Finally, he came to a spot where he felt there were a number of ways the boy could have gone. He spied a ruddy stain on a more jagged rock. He looked closer and saw it was indeed old blood, but not more than a few days. At least the storm had not reached this far, he thought to himself. He then deduced at this point the boy was still alive or there would be substantially more blood. The chief rested there for a moment to let his eyes adjust to the new landscape. Ahead, he saw signs that someone, or something, had scaled a dusty hill on all fours. He allowed himself a small smile and pursued. Cresting the hill, he was robbed of breath by the spectacular view. The hill he was atop dropped precipitously down several lengths of men and flattened out into what looked like hard sand-colored rock. The rock was barely two men's length before a huge gap he could not see the bottom of. He could see the far side of the chasm, but it was several villages across. All about him was sand, rock, and the few tree-like shrubs stubborn enough to find nutrients where there were precious few. As clearly as there was an ascension on the other side of this hill, there were tracks and a small spray of debris where the trailblazer landed down this side. From the looks of it, it was not a graceful descent. The chief picked his spots and slowly lowered himself down, controlling his slides when he could. He landed triumphantly at the bottom and took in what he had just done. The hill seemed more treacherous from the bottom, but not nearly as treacherous as what he saw when he looked over the edge. His stomach lurched and he dove away from the edge, scuttling away from it like it was about to eat him. He mustered up the courage to look again, this time slithering up to it like a snake, one small movement at a time. Across the vast expanse of the chasm, there was a translucent layer of mist hinting at darkness and depth. There were even birds floating back and forth in lazy circles above the light haze. He slithered away from the edge again and tried to find tracks leading away from the slide down, but the rock was too solid to allow the indented prints of anything smaller than a boulder. The chief was at a loss. He tried to imagine what the boy would do from this point and decided that youthful curiosity would lead the boy to follow the ledge. But which way? He surveyed each direction to determine which would be more interesting to a boy's eyes. He decided to take the northerly route toward a mountain range that must have appeared godly in the flashing clouds. Luckily, the chief took the correct direction. Unluckily, he quickly found a clue that made him want to be sick. There was one footprint parallel to the chasm, then a boy-sized chunk out of the ledge, as if the boy's next step started a small rock slide that swept him into the abyss. The chief fell to his knees and let out a wail that echoed the anguish in his voice many seconds later. The chief worked up some courage to look over the edge. "Hello, chief!" a tiny voice exclaimed. A little head popped out of the rock directly below him. He grunted, startled, and made no attempt to acknowledge the new wet spot under his leather covering. "Dear boy, how did you survive? Is it your ghost I am seeing?" "No, chief. I found a little cave down here when the storm came." "How in the gods' names did you find it down there?" "Well, I lowered myself down with a shrub that was right there," pointing to the spot of the small rock slide. "And just as my feet touched below, the shrub fell away. I was very lucky. Please don't tell my mother. She'll be worried too much." "I think you are well beyond those worries. She is the one who sent me to look for you." "Well, I was just about to head back. Why was she worried?" "You've been gone for many days, boy." "The land kept calling me forward. I had to follow," the boy replied meekly. "Is that so? What was it saying to you?" "Learn from me to know how to guide your people," the boy stated with no compunction. "Then it is time I teach you of the land and how it came to be. But first, let me help you up and we can start our long trek back." As the chief stood up, he swept some loose dirt over the darkened spot he created, then knelt down to offer his assistance to the boy. He grabbed the boy's outstretched hands, hoisting him up with one mighty pull. They then had a leisurely sit on the ledge of the great chasm. You see, during the early times, the great bird of trickery ruled the roost, and there were only giants and giant animals. There was almost no land. It was mostly water all about. Many of the birds at this time approved of this arrangement because they had their air to fly around and the water to float upon. plenty of fish to eat, and nary a bird was used for food by the giants or animals. There were contests of agility and strength to pass the time between meals, and hunting for the giants and the giant animals. However, the great bird of trickery started to get bored of this and sought to create havoc among the increasingly cramped dwellers on the small amount of land. His least favorite resident was the greatest of giants named Urf. He would pit all of the animals against the giant, and yet the giant was able to fend off these unsolicited attacks, and soon only the cubs of the great animals were left. This is why there are so few giant animals anymore. Those that do remain were the ones smart enough to see through the great bird of trickery's ruses, and they have never forgotten. With nearly all the gullible animals vanquished, the giant began heaping insults and cross words onto the great bird of trickery, much to the bird's offense. There was one great animal left who was smarter than the gullible ones, but conniving enough to realize there was profit to be had in this venture. She waited and waited, slowly winding the path to her services tighter and tighter around the great bird. "I am so quick," she would say one day while passing by the bird, and then she'd be gone in an instant. "I am so smart," she would say the next day. At first, the great bird of trickery would have nothing of it. But as each increasingly fierce animal was downed by the giant, the great bird of trickery gave more and more credence to the tiny, sinister voice he would hear but never find. Finally, on the day when the proudest of beasts, the great lion of the plain, was bested, after a day-long fight, the lion's laziness and lack of endurance proved fatal. The giant craned his fat neck and warty face toward the great bird. He grimaced in a proud display of his gaped, crooked teeth that could easily make him the world's first eater of birds. Inspired by panic and a strange burning sensation to keep his neck whole, the great bird finally consented when the voice returned. "If you are so quick and smart and know how to take the giant down sweetly, do so, and I'll give you whatever you want," he squawked. "Make a spell right now that will make me a goddess the moment the giant's head hits the ground." With a flourish of wings, loud squawking words, and a jumble of color flowing through his feathers, the great bird of trickery cast just a spell. "Now, to do this, I need you to stay in the dream world until the giant is dead, so you are not in harm's way from my magnificent fighting." The great bird was secretly relieved at this request, because he was realizing with nervousness that each felled animal showed how powerful the giant was, and if this last shot at defeating the giant failed, his feathers and wings would be the trophy paraded around till the end of time. Also, if this voice was confident enough to take on the giant after all that had transpired, perhaps it was best to view this competition from afar and trick the voice out of the spellbinding after the dust had settled. With a crack that rang across the small land and huge expanse of water, the great bird of trickery unwittingly saw his last glimpse of the waking world completely by his own power. Within the first half day, the great bird was livid. It appeared as if nothing was happening, and the giant was merely sitting around, dumbly itching various parts and picking his teeth with a great lion's jawbone. When the sun was at its highest point in the sky, the giant began losing control of his limbs, Soon after, his head started lolling around limply on his neck. Then his whole body collapsed on the ground, and his head smacked the rock hard. Just then, the great bird began to understand the folly of his ways. From the far side of the giant's limp body came the form of the most horrendous goddess the great bird could have ever imagined. Giant pinching teeth, myriad eyes, hair everywhere, and eight macabre legs that kept her bulbous torso close to whatever surface she was clinging to. Her form moved over the fallen giant like an evil hand, slowly dispensing a silky thread to bind the giant's hands and feet. Timidly, the great bird of trickery tried to slip out of the dream world and discovered all his exits were sealed. He was confused, a bit scared and hungry. He tried and tried again to leave the dream world, and each time he met an invisible force that kept him from leaving. He looked back into the waking world to see that while the giant was certainly down and incapacitated, he was still snoring and drooling. It dawned on him then that the newly deified great spider was now capable of keeping the giant in this state for as long as she cared to, and she knew this from the onset of her bargaining. This was how the land was formed. I believe we are now on one of the giant's legs, looking at the great space between this leg and his other. And the giant mountain to our right is his member, from which all the rains come. His tears and drool make the many lakes and rivers. His southern hairy patch is the jungle surrounding his mountain of manhood. His flabby gut and chest are the rolling hills to the far north. His arms are peninsulas surrounded by seas made by his sweat. The chief then paused and a serious look settled on his face. If you ever come across a large cavern, boy, be sure to flee at once because it is part of the giant you do not want to be in. The dank darkness will confuse you, the awful smells will suffocate you, and you will never be able to find your way out again. In a more storytelling cadence, the chief continues. His face makes rough hills, valleys, and caves that are even further north of the rolling hills bordered by the receding dark forest of his hair. The land moves from time to time because the giant is only sleeping under the great spider's poison. This was quite a lot of imagery for the boy to process, so he stayed silent for some time. "Where did the people come from?" he asked eventually. "They say a tribe came out of the giant's eyes, pale like the whites of our eyes. They journeyed north, and we have not heard from them since." "A tribe came out of his ears and journeyed east to better hear the coming of the dawn. We see them from time to time, and they bring spices and cloth. We give skins and drums and meat in return." "A tribe came out of the giant's cavernous nose, and to this day they live in caves, hairy all over and shy of people. A tribe came out of the mouth and scattered among the others as singers, storytellers, and shamans. I have a belief that they have a secret tribe they are truly loyal to." "Oh," breathed the boy, "where did we come from?" "Between you and me, we came from the giant's member to better populate the land with sturdy and worthy folk." The boy giggled and rolled around on the ground. And after the tears stopped streaming and he could control his breathing again, a new dawning occurred in his mind. The dancing, rituals, and funny glances cast between boys and girls, men and women, made more sense. Another thought popped into his head. "Well, where did our neighbors come from before they attacked us?" There was a slow intake of breath from the chief as he considered to answer. "To tell you the truth, boy, they came from the asshole." I shot coffee through my nose with impressive force. After the stinging subsided and most of the large drops were cleaned off my clothes and the story-laden notepad, I had to read it again. That night, I took the liberty to transcribe his writings. I went to clean it up a little, but not as much as one might expect given the circumstances. It wasn't necessary. I was never a very good typer, typist, but the words just flowed through my fingers. I took a gamble on guessing the frequency of his walks by the cafe. Risky, I know, considering the sample size. But I had to put my real-world priorities first for the next couple days and really grind out the rest of my dissertation. By the third day, the day I estimated he would be back, I was in the final editing mode for my paper and started to outline the presentation I would have to defend against onslaughts from the dean and other professors during panels. Today, I had the foresight to order a pot of coffee for my table with two mugs and plenty of cream and sugar. I picked up my bagel for a few minutes and was starting to actually get engrossed in my work when I heard the familiar rhythmic shuffle of shoes and rumbling, mumble humming of the blind man. "Fancy meeting you here," he broke into an amiable grin. "Please, have a seat. I got some coffee, cream and sugar here if you'd like. I got a whole pot, since I'll be working here most of the day, I think." "Much obliged," sounded like mush oblige. "Would you mind pouring it for me?" I noticed a slight slur to the words. He downed the offering I made for him and seemed impervious to the heat of the liquid. His whole body relaxed back into the chair, except his right arm. That was going directly for the pen and paper I had out. In seconds, he was scratching and mumbling in full force. I kept poking away at my editing and outlining, but I admit freely most of my focus was on the blind man. His mumbling was somewhere between the Buddhist Nam-myoho-renge-kyo and a blues singer dirge. The scratching of pen on paper was providing a very hypnotic beat that provided counterpoint to his sing-song-like humming. It was like observing a ritual healer deep in meditation. The unnaturally fast movement of the pen in his hand made it appear like he was using magic. He spent a fair amount of the morning there, most of it writing and some of it slipping into what seemed like a trance, but what were probably catnaps, since his head would eventually lower to his chest, then pop back up, and his hand would begin its delightful dance anew. I poured him two more, which he drank quickly. Then, just as my stomach started to growl for lunch, he stood up, tipped his hat, and started shuffling along. "When can we have coffee next?" I intone, still entranced by his extremely meditative countenance. "Well, it seems like we ran into each other a couple times already, so it'll happen again. I don't really follow your same kind of time scheme, so I'll see ya when I see ya." He cackled down the sidewalk at his own favorite joke. I promised myself I would finish the section of my paper I was working on before I tore into his new story. But I break promises to myself with some regularity.
Written, edited, and produced by Sam Lett. Narrated by Sky Wagoner.